the Pharisees gathered to him. But some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" And he said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.' You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." And he said to them, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and your mother. Whoever reviles father or mother must surely die.' But you say, 'If a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is korban, that is, given to God,' then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And many such things you do." And he called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him." And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable, and he said to them, "Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, whatever comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person." And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment. And they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears. And after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be opened." And his ears were opened, and his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one, but the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute." One of the most intriguing passages in the Gospels, at least from my perspective, is the story of the Greek woman in Mark 7. So much so that when I was in grad school, I took a class on the Synoptic Gospels, and I wrote a paper on this story with the Greek woman. It's just a story that doesn't seem to fit. It doesn't seem to make sense. And what I want you to see this morning, as we've been working our way through the Gospel of Mark, and now we're in chapter 7, is how perfectly the story of the Greek woman actually fits here in Mark 7. And what actually is happening here with Jesus and his disciples and the rulers and all the other bystanders, because there's a few statements and a few things within Mark 7 that seem confusing or disorienting, or maybe statements that we don't understand why he's saying what he's saying. Even Mark's narrative statement in verse 20, "Thus he declared all foods clean." What does this mean? So Mark 7 is a little puzzling. times it seems a little confusing in the course of everything else that we're looking at in the Gospel of Mark. And certainly Jesus seems to take on a completely different personality in the middle part of Mark 7 than we've seen previously from him in the Gospel of Mark, which is one sign of how to interpret the text. And so I want us to understand some things that are going on here in Mark, the 7th chapter. Let's begin just looking at the structure of the story itself as we think about how we got here to Mark 7 and where we're going to go as we leave Mark 7. This is going to help us understand what's actually happening here in this encounter with the Pharisees and the encounter with this Greek woman, this Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, that comes to Jesus. Jesus is on a little getaway. Even Jesus took vacations. Right? He goes over here to Tyre and Sidon, and he's trying to get into this house privately where no one else knows where he is. He's been busy. He's been healing people. He's been going all over the region, teaching, preaching, healing. And now he just wants to get away for a little while. And these encounters typically happen in this sort of way. This woman finds him. And she has a request for him, that he heal her little daughter, who has this evil spirit, this unclean spirit within her. And surprisingly, Jesus rejects her request. He kind of brushes her off and says, I have to feed the children first and not throw the bread to the dogs. What an insulting comment from Jesus the Messiah. How is it he could speak to this woman in this way? Well, let's understand some things here about the text and where we've come from. First of all, before what's even on the screen there in chapter 5, you may remember, those of you who were here and as we've preached through this book, you may remember that in chapter 5, he goes to Decapolis and he heals the demoniac, this man that has legion within him, these demons, these evil spirits. He casts him out and they go into these pigs, into the swine, which then run off the bank. And the people of Decapolis are very scared of Jesus and who he is. And they say, please get out of here. They beg him to leave. So Jesus' first encounter here in Gentile territory does not go very well. He heeds their request and he leaves. And he comes back into Jewish territory, and through various other events, what we find is him feeding the 5,000. Now, what we don't have time to discuss this morning about Mark 7 and the surrounding text are some of the terms that keep finding their way in the text. For instance, there's all these bread stories and all these boat stories. Jesus is traveling from place to place, and all these stories, including the one we're looking at here with the Greek woman, involve bread and feeding people, or at least references to them, and kind of tie this whole context together. And there is certainly some aspect here to the messianic banquet, an Old Testament idea that the one who would come would then feed his people in the wilderness. And so he feeds the 5,000 in chapter 6, and he does this miraculous walking on the water, and he heals people at the end of that text. And the Pharisees come. And as the Pharisees do, they find problems with whoever they encounter. They have problems with Jesus' disciples. They say, look, they're not eating with clean hands. They're defiled when they eat. What are you going to say about that, Jesus? They present this problem to him. They're not holding the tradition of the elders. So Jesus does have some things to say about his disciples, but he has a lot more to say about the Pharisees and about their practices. The vileness of their hearts, even though they eat with clean hands, comes to the top of the list of Jesus' responses. As he quotes Isaiah, that they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They can do all these cleanings of their hands or of pots and vessels and cups and dining couches and all the things they're concerned with cleaning everything in sight and trying to make it ritualistically pure. But in the end, it's really their heart that is defiled. And that's what Jesus focuses on with these Pharisees. And as tends to happen in these encounters with the Pharisees, the others don't tend to understand. The disciples especially, sometimes they're worried that he even offends the Pharisees. You've offended these people who are the beacons of righteousness in our society. And so Jesus has to teach them, and he says, then are you also without understanding? This kind of phrase that flows throughout this text. The disciples don't get it. They don't understand Jesus, and they don't understand what he's trying to accomplish. They don't quite get the point he's making here. And so he has to do some more teaching about what defilement actually is. And in the process of that, it says, thus he declared all foods clean. Kind of an interesting statement to the Jews listening to this, which is the initial setting. Of course, Mark is narratively saying this, but what he's saying is that the words of Jesus are making this declaration that all foods are clean. Remember the context that the Pharisees are worried that they're eating without clean hands. And what he's saying is that all food is kosher. It's good. You can eat it. And he's speaking here within the realm of Jewish dietary laws. I think that's what Jesus is doing. Now, later on, as Mark is narrating the story, I think the meaning is much more broad, and he connects it with the story that is to follow this Greek woman, this Gentile, this unclean woman. And so he's doing something a little more with that. But the initial audience is probably just thinking of their normal diet. You don't have to wash your hands before you eat. All food is clean. Mark's going to expand that a little bit. The real point is to uproot the common views of purity and cleanliness. Acts 10:28 may help us understand this a little bit more. You remember that Peter goes to the house of Cornelius and he tells them, "You yourself know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or visit anyone of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any person common or unclean." So the implication here is that from the Jewish perspective, a woman like this, really anyone of any foreign nation, as Peter says it, a Gentile, whether they're a Greek or a barbarian, it doesn't matter, they're all unclean, they're all impure. And one of these terms and ideas we need to see flowing through the Mark 7 text is the idea of purity and cleanliness, because he's playing on this term all the way through. And so they're concerned that the disciples are eating with defiled hands. They're not eating cleanly, which is leading to this teaching on cleanliness, this teaching on defilement, and then this illustration in the life of this Greek woman, this unclean woman whose little daughter has an unclean spirit who comes to Jesus. And so there is an opportunity here for Jesus to do some teaching to his disciples. This is a really puzzling text. And if you were to do a little bit of research or study on it, what you would likely find is that many, many groups want to use this text to kind of turn this story into something that supports their ideas of what the world should be like. And so this is a very strong kind of feminist type of interpretation from Mark 7. Or any kind of marginalized group wants to go to the Mark 7 text and say, look at this woman who stood up to Jesus. She claimed her place at the table and she demanded to be paid attention to. And as interesting as that sounds, it just completely denies everything that is actually in the text itself. Operates from an extreme point of bias with many, many assumptions read into the text. What's actually interesting about this woman, who the text identifies as Greek, your translation most likely says Gentile, probably trying to emphasize this motif of cleanliness or unclean or purity or impurity. We are more familiar with the idea of Gentiles being unclean, but the text actually in Greek says Greek. She is a Greek woman. There's a level of status comes from this. And so some of these ideas that she's this poor woman who is impoverished, who's marginalized in society, and so she comes and she demands that Jesus heal her daughter, is really missing many things about what is actually in the text itself. She's actually a woman of status, it seems, in the text. And there are many indicators of this. She is a Greek woman. Jesus, in fact, is on her turf. If anything, it's actually just the opposite. If there's anyone that's marginalized in the story, it would be Jesus. Jesus is in Tyre and Sidon. He is not in Jewish territory. He would have been looked out as an outcast in this area. For centuries, Tyre and Sidon had had socioeconomical power and dominion over Israel, which may go into some of the statements about bread and feeding children and throwing it to dogs and those sorts of things. We don't know all the idioms and all the phrases that may have existed, but for centuries, Tyre and Sidon had taken the bread from Israel and have been using it for their own people. And so now Jesus is saying in his response, which is somewhat of a riddle, I have to feed the children first and not throw it to the dogs, much like probably the people of Tyre and Sidon have been doing for centuries, feeding their own children and throwing it to the dogs and depriving the people of Israel. So all throughout the story is interesting turn of terms and words. And we don't know exactly. We know this may be even better than ancient people. This is one of these occasions where I can say we probably know better than the ancients on this. We know that text doesn't identify meaning very well. How many times have you sent a text message or something on social media and it's not understood the way you intended it to be understood? And we need to consider that when we're looking at any kind of text. And so people are very puzzled. Why is Jesus being so mean to this woman? I don't know if he says this in a playful way or his terminology is in such a way that she kind of understands this is a riddle or this is not really what he's really like. I'm not exactly sure how all of this goes down. Or maybe he does come across very seriously for the very point of illustrating to his disciples what the Jewish rulers really look like. Because here's the thing with Jesus in Mark 7 with the Greek woman. He doesn't look like the Jesus of Mark 1 through 6. He looks like the Jewish rulers. He looks like the ignorant leaders in the way they treat people. And it seems to me he intends to come across that way, especially if you look at Matthew's account in Matthew chapter 15, where he kind of brushes this woman off, even to the point that he allows his disciples to say, "Send her away, Jesus. She's annoying us. Let's just get rid of this woman." In an account where he had said they have little faith, at the end of the account in Matthew 15, he says, "O woman, you have great faith." She's everything the disciples aren't. And in the end, I think Jesus intends for that idea or that concept to reach the surface. Though on the surface, initially, he may come across as harsh or mean or prejudiced against this woman. The end purpose, whether he was saying this playfully or whether he was saying it in a way that seemed real, the end purpose of this was to illustrate the point he had just made earlier about defilement. What truly makes somebody holy, what truly makes somebody defiled, is that which comes from within, not what is on the outside. And so the text may puzzle us some as we read and wonder, why would Jesus say these types of things to this poor woman? But the reality is there's a much deeper concept going on here. There are things that Jesus means to bring out that I think are helpful for us understand. And it's not that this woman is forcing herself on Jesus and demanding that he give her what she deserves and those sorts of things. She was a person of means. In fact, the word that's used there at the end of the text, that she goes home and she finds her child lying in a bed, it's not even the same word for bed that's used early in the Gospel of Mark. You remember the paralytic who's brought in on that bed? That's a mat. That's what a poor person would be on. This term for bed that's used here for this woman is more what we think of as a bed, something a wealthy person would. She's a person of status. She's a person of means. And yet she comes and she throws herself down before Jesus. She begs at his feet. She's not demanding anything about coming to the table. She'll eat the scraps that are under the table. She sees Jesus' riddle and she matches it in return. And she says, "I'll take whatever you give me." Because she's desperate to help her daughter, who has an unclean spirit. And so part of the lesson is for Jesus' disciples to see how he handles this woman. This unclean Greek, this Gentile, this Syrophoenician. Matthew throws that in there, a Canaanite, right? Just to up the prejudice just a little bit more. This Canaanite woman. How's Jesus going to handle her? And of course, initially, he handles her much like the rulers would, but in the end, we see he's quite different. But there's even something bigger in this, in terms of where this is headed in the bigger story. Not just this single isolated verse, which typically this is what happens when people misinterpret a text like Mark 7. They just take this one little story and they interpret just that one story and miss the bigger context of what's actually happening. What we need to see here, though, is that this Greek woman, she's really a gateway to the Gentile mission. To Jesus ultimately making inroads among Gentiles and his teaching going to them and then being influenced in a very positive way. Because you remember the demoniac from Decapolis back in chapter 5. When he is healed, they send him away. They're scared. They don't want to see him anymore. But now he comes to this woman in Tyre and Sidon who is a Gentile. She's a Greek. She seeks him out. She begs at his feet. He heals her daughter. And then immediately he heads back to Decapolis. Now, I wish I had a map up here on the screen so you could see the progression of Jesus' movement. It's not like he's entire inside and then he just goes like a mile over to Decapolis. No, he has to go back to the Sea of Galilee and then go to the other side. And so when Jesus leaves Tyre and Sidon, and he goes then to Decapolis, that is a very purposeful move. It is an intentional move. He's going from Tyre and Sidon, this Gentile territory. He's skipping over Jewish territory and now going back into Gentile territory, where now he heals another man, and then people are coming to him in multitudes. With the end result being in chapter 8, that he feeds the 4,000 Gentiles. And so when we see this big picture, he begins with the 5,000 Jews that he feeds in the wilderness. He ends with this messianic banquet type scene in chapter 8 where he's feeding the 4,000 Gentiles, bringing Jew and Gentile both in, including them all. And so this Greek woman, through the interesting details of her story itself, really is just a window to the greater Gentile mission. She is this initial person that Jesus deals with, which then sends him back into Decapolis, where now he begins to influence the Gentiles in an even bigger way. And so he declares all food clean. Has a little bit deeper meaning. He goes to this Gentile woman, and then he goes to the Gentiles of Decapolis, miles away on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. So let's talk about some lessons that we can learn from chapter 7. I wanted us to see the structure, the major structure of the text, to get a little bit better understanding of how all of this works. But what are some lessons that we can gain looking from Mark 7 and seeing the story with the Pharisees and seeing the story with this Greek woman? I think that the most obvious place to start is where Jesus starts with the Pharisees, and that is to be very conscious of vain worship and what that actually looks like. The Pharisees are very offended by Jesus' disciples who come in here and they have unclean hands, but what Jesus is more offended by is unclean hearts. In vain do they worship me, he says, quoting Isaiah. They honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. They can clean all the vessels and they can clean their hands. They can wear the right clothes and eat the right diet. They can offer the sacrifices, and they can go to the temple. They can offer the sacrifice of lips, to use the Hebrew writer's phrase. But unless it's also the sacrifice of their heart, it means absolutely nothing. And so Jesus, being who Jesus is, he can identify this problem with the Pharisees. They're so concerned about the outward, about clean hands and clean cups and clean couches, and yet they've missed the greater part, which is a clean heart. All those things may be fine, and all the laws they had created, which they had created these laws, many of them, about cleaning all the various things they cleaned, most of their laws had to do with cleaning things. And what they meant to emphasize is maybe not all as bad as we tend to think when we think of the Pharisees. They really wanted to indicate the holiness of God. That was their intent. But unfortunately, they had taken their own laws and they had turned them into the commandments of God. And so these two ideas go together, this idea of being aware of vain worship and what that looks like, but also realizing that it is very tempting. It is very easy sometimes to equate tradition of man with commandment of God. Pharisees had certainly done that. They had decided that if someone eats with unclean hands, they must be a vile and unclean person. Now, they're not keeping the tradition of the elders, but you notice what Jesus does in response. He said, you know what God said? To honor your father and your mother, and you don't do that. So they eat with some dirt on their hands. But you violate the commandment of God directly because of your tradition. And what may be more damning in this statement of Jesus is what he says at the end, and many such things you do. You find all kinds of ways to negate the law of God, to do things in your own way. You've come up with your own laws, and the initial intent was good in some of this. That's the danger. Sometimes we come up with our own laws and our own rules because maybe we have good intentions in the outset. But when we begin to mistake tradition with a commandment of God, very bad things start happening. Traditions are not all bad. Really, the word itself just is the idea of handing something down or handing something across. So you hand it across from one generation to the next. And in some senses, actually it's used this way within Scripture a few times, it can even talk about the commandments of God. They're handed down by the apostles. So in some senses, there are traditions that we keep that are the law of God, that are the commandments of God. And those are fine, and they need to be kept. But more of the issue, and what the Pharisees struggled with, is how do you keep the commandments of God? Well, what are the method or the means by which you fulfill the commandments that God has given us? And often the traditions that we come up with, they actually kind of form over time. We usually don't set out to just create traditions. But they form over time really with the purpose of fulfilling the commandments that God has given us. But again, we better beware that we aren't creating our traditions or forming our traditions and replacing the commandment of God. The traditions we develop are there to fulfill God's commandments. And they are not the same thing as the commandments themselves. So let's just think about that for just a moment with maybe some easy examples. For as long as I can remember, and probably for as long as many of you can remember, we sing with four-part harmony. It's just how we do it. The Lord commanded us to sing, and so this is how we sing. But you may or may not know, I don't know, that that's not how it's always been done. There's times in the past where there's been call and response. One person sings, another person responds. Maybe you've heard in your life that, well, we all need to sing together, right? Well, that then condemns these people in centuries past who were not all singing together. And so sometimes we get our own ideas of what some of these things mean because of how we do them. And those are traditions, and there's nothing wrong with singing with four-part harmony and doing it in that way. But when we begin to think that our way of doing some of these things, the means by which we carry out the commandment of God, that that becomes law and commandment itself. That's the Pharisees of Mark 7. That's taking the things that are on the surface and ignoring the things that are in the heart. Or maybe just things like the way we construct worship and the way we go through some of the motions of worship. Things could be very differently. You know, we could take a little box and we could stick it to the back and people as they come in and out could put their contribution in there. That's how the Jews did it. But you know, I've heard people criticize that before. It's kind of interesting because that's not how we do it. Again, just obvious, kind of simple examples, but the point is sometimes we become so locked in on the ways that we do things that we look at other things and we begin to think, kind of like the Pharisees here, they aren't doing it right. They're not following the traditions. And what Jesus is really concerned with is, are they worshiping correctly? Are they worshiping with a heart? Are they following the commandment of God? And the reality is, nothing his disciples were doing were violating God's commands. These were the laws of the Pharisees. These were things they came up with. There was not anything in the law that said you had to always wash your hands in the marketplace or various other places before you ate. And this is what they came up with, working off of commandments really that were for the priests. And so in their desire to take holiness to the extreme, because their focus was not on brotherly love, it was certainly not on that, but it was on the holiness of God, they built their own system. And then they judged other people by it. So if we begin to judge others because they don't do things exactly the way we do them, we're turning our traditions into doctrine. And to be honest, in the past, there have been some pretty terrible interpretations of Scripture that then become traditions that turn into doctrine. We can't run through many of those this morning. But I just want us to be honest when we come to text and thinking about what they actually are about. It's part of looking at that narrative structure of Mark. I think, what is this text actually about? Unlike doing like the feminist interpretation, just pulling out kind of what we like and turning it into what we want. That's dangerous interpretation. And so I want all of us, myself, everyone else, to think very carefully when we approach a text. is that what this text is really about? What I'm saying to somebody, and what I'm saying, which fits my tradition, which fits my preconceived notion, is that really what this text is about, whether we're in the Gospels or whether we're in the letters, the epistles, wherever we may be? Is it really fitting what Scripture is actually talking about, or is it really just what I want it to say? If we're honest, there may be some things we have to think through, rethink through, and change in our thinking. It may bother us sometimes when someone brings up something that we've always thought was wrong. And maybe it is wrong. Maybe we look back at the text and we carefully analyze the things that are there and we decide we're right about that still. But maybe if we're honest and we're careful with the text, maybe we realize that's not really what that text is teaching. And I truly hope that Jeff and I are endeavoring to do those sorts of things when we preach. We all are biased, and the first thing we have to do is try to work from that bias and realize I see things in a certain way. But I hope to the best of my ability that what I'm doing, and I think Jeff would be the same way, is that we're approaching the text and trying to teach what the text actually says. Not what I would like for it to say. What makes me feel comfortable. What sets me apart from other people or designates others as not right. And the warning here in Mark 7 is that is a very real danger. It's very easy to take things the way we've always seen them, the way our parents taught us and the way their parents taught them, and then now turn that into commandment. And at the center of this story, really the pinnacle statement of the story, which then leads to the story of the Greek woman, is that statement, thus he declares all food clean. The idea here, though it's a puzzling statement to us, is really about the idea of defilement. And his whole point in all of this is that defilement comes from within, as does holiness. Holiness comes from within. It's not that you've washed your hands in just the right way before you eat. It's not that your dining couch is clean or any of those sorts of things. That's not what makes somebody clean. It's not that we wear the right clothes and we say the right statements as we approach people and we talk to people when we come together on Sundays or on Wednesday or at various people's homes. What really matters is what we have in our heart, and that we're trying to do the will of God to the best of our ability, that we honor him not with our lips, but with our hearts. And so you can see how all of these flow together. Traditions are easy. You know what's not easy? Breaking tradition because you don't think what is happening is right. It's very easy to go with the tradition of the elders and just do what's being done. You're keeping yourself from criticism. You're keeping yourself from other people speaking evil of you or doubting your heart. Or those kinds of things. But what's hard is actually standing up and saying, I don't think that's right. Or I think that could be done a different way. Or I don't think that person's wrong because they're doing it this way, even though we do it this other way. That's a lot harder. And that's, in fact, what Jesus is encountering here with the Pharisees. Saying they don't have to wash their hands before they eat. That's something you've come up with. That's a law you've made and you've taught as a commandment of God. And in fact, more than that, he says, I think you have a big heart problem. Jesus is criticizing the hypocritical external cleansing of the Pharisees. And what he wants the people to understand who are around him is that what really matters is what's coming out of the heart, not what's entering the body. From within come evil thoughts and immorality and theft and murder and envy. That's what really matters. And so in bringing us back to the story of the Greek woman, here's what I want us to think about as we leave this morning. She is this illustration of the point that Jesus is making to the disciples, countering the attitude of the Jewish leaders. And really what the Greek woman, what she really demands for us to think, is not about taking our place at the table and forcing our place in society or any of those sorts of things. What she really demands we ask is, how far will I go to receive the power of Jesus in my life? Am I willing to throw status away? Am I willing to get rid of ego and fall before his feet? and say, I'll take whatever you give me. This woman has a very practical situation in her life, her daughter who is sick, who has this unclean spirit. And what she says is, I'll do whatever it takes, Jesus. I will come and bow before your feet. I don't care who you are. I know who you are, unlike the disciples, unlike the Jewish rulers, who though they had seen the power of God, they don't accept it. They don't receive it. She heard about Jesus and she came to him. And maybe you've heard about Jesus this morning and you've come. We have a lot of visitors this morning. And maybe you know some things about Jesus. Maybe you've heard some of these stories. Maybe you're here because your mother wants you to be here. Maybe she's desperate. And she wants you to be healed. Maybe it's just falling on her feet before Jesus every night and begging that he will heal you, that he'll make you whole. And if that's the case, you need to leave here this morning thinking very carefully about that. This mother went to a great extent to save her daughter. How far will I go to receive the power of Jesus? How far will I go for my child to receive the power, the saving power of Jesus? And it may be this morning you're here because of a parent. You're here because of your mother. That happens often on Mother's Day. And I'm not saying this to try to beat down on you and tell you you've been a bad person or those kinds of things. It's actually just the opposite. What I want for you is to realize how desperately your mother wants you here. Just like this mother desperately wanted her daughter healed. She's not a Jew. She's a pagan. And they have all kinds of gods. But she came to Jesus because she knew that he had the power to heal. Will you come to Jesus this morning? Why don't you come now as we stand and we sing together?